welcome to the 12th edition of Exploring Environmental History, and I'm your host, Jan Oosthoek. This edition, entitled History and Sustainability, is reporting on a conference with the same title that was held at the University of Cambridge's Centre for Research in the Arts, Social Sciences and Humanities on 6th and 7th September 2007. The conference was co-organised by the Centre for History and Economics at King's College, University of Cambridge, and the Higher Education Academy Subject Centre for History, Classics and Archaeology. This conference explored a number of perspectives on the contribution that historians can make to contemporary debates about sustainability. Some listeners will probably wonder how historians can contribute to the question of sustainability, since this is normally the domain of scientists and policymakers. In order to clarify why the theme of the conference is not as odd as it seems at first sight, I talked to one of the organizers of the conference, Paul Ward, who is a reader in history at the University of East Anglia. Looking at the title, it's very intriguing to have this combination of history and sustainability, because a lot of people would not think that these two are related, that sustainability belongs to environmental science or science subjects in general. Why then this conference?
Well, on a very basic level, as with so many things, one answer is logistics. There is government money that's been made available to promote education for sustainable development, and some of that has been directed towards some of our co-funders of this meeting, such as the Higher Education Academy, who are spending it within the area of history. So there is a supply side to the meeting, but it would be quite wrong to think that that's where the interest or the ideas have come from, although it is a necessity for holding meetings like this. I think, first and foremost, sustainability as a concept can only be understood historically. Sustainability is about survival of something over time. And if history is concerned with anything, of course, it's about development over time, change within time. Of course, it looks at other aspects of the world and social change as well. But sustainability has to be something that endures. And in many ways, history is a study of what endures or what does not endure. What are the reasons for this? And so sustainability is a central concern for history in a way that helps us both understand earlier societies and also potentially the direction that we're going in now. I think there's a further aspect, though, where history can make an important contribution to the study of sustainability, and that's when anything becomes a very significant concept and widely used politically. It's very important to understand what are the roots of that idea, where does it come from, what systems of thinking is it associated with. And again, that requires an understanding of the historical roots of the idea and its application. We have to understand how our thinking about our present problems is shaped by the past.
This meeting is also partly about teaching sustainability. And in this afternoon's discussion, it became very clear that there are some difficulties how to infuse it in the curriculum. What would you see as the most challenging part or parts of teaching sustainability within the history curriculum?
Well, I think in some ways any aspects of sustainability questions can be fitted relatively easily intellectually into history, and the barriers that are there that are introducing it into history courses are much ones of habit and institutionalization as anything else. Now, if we're looking at some aspects of sustainability, I think generally they require an understanding of things that are traditionally associated with the natural sciences, and getting those onto history curricula and incorporating them into courses in a way that's valued in the courses. And sometimes, of course, trying to bring people in the university from different departments together, which in its own right requires a lot of effort, creates barriers. I don't think insurmountable barriers by any means, but we have to think about ways of moving things forward. And, you know, developments that allow us to teach sustainability effectively don't just happen. They have to be reflected on and worked out, and we want to look at best practice for doing that. So there is that aspect of bringing in things from the sciences, but it's also important to remember that sustainability isn't simply a question of us understanding natural processes and how they have affected us throughout history. Sustainability is also about a certain choice, whether we make it consciously or not, about our environments. And for thousands of years, if not tens of thousands of years, humans have had a very profound impact on the way that they shape the world that they live in, as well as being shaped by it. And I think one of the problems, in a sense, in a wider understanding of sustainability and explaining its importance to people and the role of history in appreciating it, is that sustainability isn't just something, it's not a given out there that we need to find, that scientists show us what is sustainable. Actually, it's about choices that society makes, political choices that societies make about the kind of world that they would like to live in and whether that is possible or not. And science can only provide a certain amount of guidance to that. And in fact, very often what science tells us about sustainability, both in the present and in the past, only tells us about probabilities or likelihoods. And I think there's then a strong, if you like, humanistic or interpretative aspect that comes into it, that we have to understand then how people negotiate the kind of results, the society, the world they would like to see. And this is absolutely what history is about.
And education as well, because in order to change people's behaviour and make society more sustainable, you need to educate people. And that is something that the higher education academy is very concerned about at present.
Yes. I mean, I come from the background of being trained as a historian, and one thing, of course, that comes out in the debates is a certain reticence on the part of historians to speak clearly about what should be rather than describing about what has happened and why it might have happened. I mean, this hasn't always been the case for history, and there, of course, have always been and still are historians who are strong advocates. But I think we have to be cautious, both in perhaps developing kind of concepts of sustainability and people's understanding of the world we'd like to see, but also in producing good and rigorous academic work. You know, one has to be cautious in being too didactic of saying, again, you know, pretending sustainability isn't about a set of choices. Now, of course, we want to avoid clearly unsustainable choices, but that doesn't mean there's just one sustainable way of doing things. And I think what history can do, again, as it can do with so many policy matters, is open up areas of debate that people may not have previously thought about, understandings that are gained through looking at past societies and their experiences. So it's kind of opening people's minds to think about and reflect on questions that they otherwise wouldn't. And that, in the end, is what education is about. It's not necessarily about providing the answer. It's about setting the problem that we then have to solve together.
Looking at the programme of this conference, you've brought together quite a wide range of people, also from abroad. It's quite an international group. What do you hope to learn from this conference?
Well, environmental change and social reaction to it is a fundamentally global problem. It's an issue that works at every scale, and I think it's important to bring as many different understandings to that. And I mean, it's a delight at the conference that we have people from the UK, Scandinavia, people from Australia, someone from Brazil who is perhaps seeing, you know, the other end of the chains of, you know, production and consumer relations and environmental degradation. So it's important to have those different perspectives to bring a whole to it. But I think something like history, the study of history and our understanding of history has been very strongly shaped by national identities, national institutions. And so it's very useful to shed light on our own practice and what we do to bring these perspectives from elsewhere and learn what is useful, not successful about them, how much things that we perhaps think are almost natural or are shaped by quite open academic debate that turn out to be very much the properties of particular countries in the background that we come from. And without that kind of international comparison and discussion, it's hard to gain those perspectives. And that's something that I've certainly gained greatly from in the discussions we've had so far.
Yes, the environment doesn't stop at borders. Well, thank you very much for joining me.
Okay, thank you.
The idea of sustainability is founded on continuity through time and draws us immediately in historical perspectives. And yet, historians have contributed relatively little to debates about sustainable development or examined in detail the origins and range of historical ideas of sustainability. Environmental history is ideally placed to make this contribution to the sustainability debate, both through teaching and research. In order to explore how this can be achieved, the conference examined the following themes. First of all, international developments in teaching of environmental history. Secondly, the current directions and debates within environmental history, as well as its position within the humanities and the science arenas. Thirdly, historical ideas of sustainability and the role of history in educating for sustainable development in higher and pre-university education. In the remainder of this podcast, I will focus on the second group of themes, current directions and debates within environmental history, as well as its position within the humanities and science arenas. During the roundtable discussion of the first day, it became clear that, although environmental history is growing, with courses established or being established at the universities of Nottingham, East Anglia, Lincoln, Sussex, Newcastle and Stirling, to mention only a small number, the position and direction of the subject is academically far from clear. This observation connected seamlessly with the first session of the day, which was a discussion centered around the article "The Problem of the Problem of Environmental History, a Rereading of the Field," which was published in the January 2007 issue of the journal Environmental History and written by Sverker Sörlin of the Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm in Sweden and by Paul Ward. This essay argued that environmental history, in order to become more mainstream in the social sciences and humanities, should pay more attention to social and political theory. However, many participants of the meeting felt that the analysis of the paper, that environmental historians are not enough engaged with social theory, is much too negative and limited. Many historians, as well as social and political scientists, write also environmental history using, for example, world systems theory and social theory. However, many of them do not call their work environmental history. The same can be observed on the science side of the academic spectrum. Nevertheless, environmental history is still far from mainstream, and the question is why. One possible way of infusing environmental history into mainstream scholarship was suggested by one of the authors of the Problem of Environmental History paper, Sverker Sörlin. He proposed that we need a shift in perspective on historical events by combining disparate case studies in a new synthesis to achieve this. During a coffee break, I caught up with Sverker and asked him to explain further what he meant with the change of perspective.
You were talking during the discussion earlier this morning about the fact that environmental history is still not mainstream, or a lot of people feel it's still not mainstream. And you were saying or suggesting that maybe a change of perspective is needed in order to get it more into the mainstream of history. What do you mean with a change of perspective?
Well, I think I meant rather that the change of perspective needs to be for history as a whole. I mean, the history needs to be... History has changed as a discipline, of course, and it's been much enriched in recent decades by many new perspectives, including environmental history. I think this is not the end. It's going to keep on. And in that respect, I think there is a very crucial mission for environmental history to be affecting history even more than it has hitherto. And the argument, I think, that we should advocate this change to make history more environmental, so to speak, is that our world is changing. The role of the environment is constantly growing. Climate change is upon us all. And to understand the human predicament, to understand current societies and to discuss our future and to learn from the past means involving more environmental perspectives. So that is the kind of perspective change. In fact, this gives a crucial role to environmental historians to be part of that. In order to do that, I also think we might need to reconsider some of the preoccupations and peculiarities of environmental history to make our job more efficiently to affect history.
So that's actually what you discussed in your article with Paul Ward, the problem of environmental history to make it more relevant.
I would like to put it this way. Maybe we haven't even so far realized how potentially important we are. So that we are emitting very large diversity, we are happy with what we are doing, whatever we are doing, and we don't care too bloody much about institutional presence and things like that. We have a job to do, which is not just rigorously carrying out our important historical work, but also to realize that we should be part of policy making, we should be part of even university policy making, to affect agendas, to affect programs, to affect departments, to take on a role that is the one we should have simply because of the world we have around us. There's a responsibility there too.
That also means a responsibility in teaching students.
Oh, absolutely. There is more undergraduates around the world should be aware of the kinds of perspectives that environmental history could provide. And I think most often that is a teaching that is provided by historians, but it could certainly be provided by others as well. It should be taught in science departments and science faculties and in medical schools, schools of technology, not the least, business schools. And of course, you couldn't create history departments everywhere. Sometimes you need to have, so to speak, vanguard troops of individual people. I do not advocate this because of a sort of disciplinary egotism that precisely our field should expand, but simply because it is a kind of the kinds of issues that are needed for global change.
And finally, you were also suggesting to get a more firm footing for environmental history, that maybe we should pay, as historians, environmental historians, more attention to social theory, theory in general, maybe.
Well, I think to gain recognition also for our research among our peers, we need to be really demonstrating not just that we provide some fair and important perspectives, but also that we make real progress and become read and cited by other historians, and so that there is quality work. And I mean, that's true for everybody. It's certainly true for us as well. We couldn't hide behind some sort of world mission and do sort of less than standard work simply because we have a mission. We have to do both. It's absolutely essential. You gain legitimacy for the mission only if you got the rigor and the quality of the work in teaching and research.
That means that we still have a lot of work to do.
Well, we all have a lot of work to do. That's true for other historians as well. But again, I think the kinds of issues that we deal with and the kinds of perspectives and the relations to global change and global environmental issues makes this a bit more acute, I think, for our field than for many others.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Environmental history is also about combining perspectives, and therefore the discipline is inherently interdisciplinary. This raises questions about the nature of environmental history and whether it is a subdiscipline in its own right. Some participants argued that environmental history forms bridges between subjects. Another way of seeing this is that environmental history is a marketplace where different disciplines contribute to solving an historical problem. In this view, environmental history facilitates and encourages discourse between the disciplines. It is more than the subjects involved and goes beyond the sciences and humanities to form something that is completely different and cannot be described within the framework of conventional academic disciplines. However, this view could lead to alienation of disciplines, and therefore environmental historians must pay close attention to rigor in their research, the understanding and use of vocabularies, and the relevance of what they are doing. These three issues were brought up by Kate Showers, a research fellow at the Center for World Environmental History of the University of Sussex. During the lunch break, I talked with Kate about this.
During the discussions this morning, you made a comment that environmental historians should pay attention to three issues, actually. You mentioned rigor, vocabulary, and relevance. I actually would add quality as well, but I'll leave this out for now. And you said that these issues are really important to make environmental history more acceptable in mainstream historical studies or mainstream scientific studies. What do you mean with rigor, vocabulary, and relevance?
Environmental history requires a synthesis of more than one discipline. And in order to make a proper synthesis, it means one has to learn the methods and the techniques of each discipline that you're going to synthesize. And when you do this, you must honor the rules associated with the proper use of these techniques in their discipline of origin, so that when you make the synthesis and you make your final statements, what you present will meet the standards of rigor of all the disciplines. So it has to be, it can't be attacked for being weak. You come from history and you talk about climate change, you don't understand how the model works. Someone in climate change can say, well, that's ridiculous. Look at the models got wrong. You've got to have the basics right. That's what I mean about rigor.
It's actually courtesy as well.
Oh, yes. You must respect each discipline's integrity. You may not understand the sophistication of the discipline, but you've got to find out what their barriers are and not break them. You have to violate. You can't take a piece of them. If you take just a part of a technique and not the entire context, it will probably not work, and it certainly will be invalid. That works completely with statistics. You've got to understand statistics if you're going to use it.
That brings us actually to vocabulary. If you don't understand statistics, the vocabulary of it, you cannot work with it.
Yes, I think it's very important to learn about vocabulary in each discipline has its own words that they define in the beginning and then people use over and over and over again. And after a while, the term becomes kind of blurred and very broad in its concept, but also unintelligible to another discipline. So I think it's really important that when you go to each discipline, first of all, for your own understanding, you have to decode those words and then figure out how to express the idea in a language that words that can be found in any dictionary. Because after you've learned this, you have to go back and express it to an interdisciplinary audience, which means everybody has to be able to understand it. So when you go about using non-jargon words, it's actually harder work to make a simple sentence because you have to be very precise. You have to be clear in your own mind and then precise in the words you use to say what it is you're talking about. That's defining the problem and also organizing any kind of solution. Also, even the simple words can be kind of loaded, like the idea of power. In many disciplines, power has a whole lot of meanings that have been applied from other authors. You can talk about this important idea, just as you can talk about gender and class, without using those words. And when you don't use those words, you won't put off people who find those words to be ideologically loaded. But the concepts are important. So I think it's really important in order to enhance discussion, to bring down as many barriers as possible, whether they're conceptual or vocabulary.
This is also very important in teaching our students, the techniques of not only environmental history, but I think in general, to phrase their work in non-jargon. But also that brings us, I think, to relevance, to connecting actually with other audiences, and also make it relevant to present-day problems. And you can only do that when you can make it understandable.
One of the fundamental strengths of environmental history, and I would think the only reason for its existence, is relevance. It can be relevant to the academy or academia, or it can be, and it must also be relevant in terms of problems that we perceive. As far as history is concerned, Brazilian historian José Antonio Padua argues that environmental history perspectives can enrich the typical historical debates by bringing up things that have not been considered before and bringing a fresh new idea of problem definition and problem understanding. Environmental history can also be a vehicle for uniting otherwise diverse disciplines and ideas in a way that enriches the interpretation of subject matter, whether that's in the social sciences, humanities, or sciences. Because everything occurs in time and everything has an environmental context, but these are not always recognized. And when you recognize them, you can suddenly increase the understanding of what it is you're trying to think about. The other thing is how to make it relevant at a personal level is that most people in the world are anxious or worried about something in the environment in which they live. Toxins, floods, air quality, water supply, something like this. And this general population includes undergraduate students. Mm-hmm. So that when you bring them an environmental history perspective, it helps them think about things that maybe they just have sort of a nervous worry about, and it helps them be clear about their thought. And when environmental history is expressed in ordinary vocabulary, it provides a coherent way to think about, articulate, and then take action about environmental concerns. This could increase student enrollment as well as produce more responsible citizens. It can be very helpful for activists because they're going to have a less simplistic way of expressing whatever it is they're worried about and have a more coherent and acceptable response. Environmental history can also help policymakers because as a policymaker, they're supposed to make a decision. And things are usually complex, and there are pieces that don't seem to fit together. But time, historical dimension, has an amazing way of helping these things fit in place so that you can see a pattern. And that helps you learn from past mistakes and not repeat them in the future, and perhaps make a more sophisticated intervention, and also help policymakers talk to activists and maybe bring down the barriers and the police brigades that separate people with banners from people in suits.
Well, that actually ties in with the discussion we had later this morning about sustainability, that history is actually at the heart of the sustainability debate, because without understanding the past, what came before, we cannot understand how sustainability worked in the past or how it can work in the future. It connects the past and the future, historical studies.
Yes, it connects the past and the future. It also helps us understand what the present really is. Libby Robin's work that's so interesting in Australia, and all the people she represents, Stephen Dovers and all those people, are talking about the fact that there really isn't a now. A now is just part of a continuum, and we're not even sure which part of the continuum we're on. And, you know, is this an extreme moment? Is this an ordinary moment? We don't really know. And environmental history can help us think about all those things.
Libby Robin's paper did not only address how history connects the past, present, and future, but also what this means for the agendas for historical research. I asked Libby, who's connected to the Fenner School of Environment and Society at the Australian National University and the National Museum of Australia in Canberra, to explain the title of her paper, The Big Here and the Long Now, Agendas for History and Sustainability.
I very much enjoyed your talk earlier today, which was entitled The Big Here and the Long Now, Agendas for History and Sustainability. This title clearly breaks down into pieces. And the first one is, of course, the big here and the long now. Why the first part of this title, and how does it connect to environmental history?
Well, first of all, it's not my title, it's Brian Eno's, and it's the big here is the idea of one Earth, so that the whole Earth is one place, and it's very spatial. And so it comes from, I guess, our heritage in geography rather than our history. Mm-hmm. But the long now adds time. And so the idea of time and responsibility with a moral purpose is very important for imagining the two together. And I think that Brian Eno did try and put them together in his music, mm-hmm. and also through the Long Now Foundation. But I also think there's something in it for us historians, the idea that we're thinking of a community that is the whole Earth, the big here, and we're thinking of time that's more than our lifetime, and that's the long now.
And that's also important for environment historians, because if you're talking about the environment, you're talking about very processes that take very long time spans and on a very large scale. So that refers also to this title. This title refers to that as well.
Yes, exactly. The idea of the agendas for history for sustainability, I guess, is to take the big here, the global perspective, which comes often from disciplines outside history, and the very long time perspectives from paleo through to futures, which are also slightly uncomfortable for history, and putting them in and making them history rather than making them earth science, for example, or something else. So we're trying to, I think responsibility is the key to it, because responsibility is the human element, and we need humanities to do that sort of work.
So actually historicising sciences that have not taken humanities on board?
No, I think taking the ideas of the science and looking at them as human concepts. So that is not changing the science. The science can still be science. Mm-hmm. But looking at how the ideas in the science have developed and why where they're coming from, who they're speaking to, who they're not speaking to. And that's what I think historians do much better than scientists.
Libby Robin's paper has been published as a co-authored article entitled History for the Anthropocene, which was published in the August 2007 issue of History Compass. Brian Eno's paper, The Big Here and Long Now, can be downloaded from the Long Now Foundation website at www.longnow.org. Before I leave today, I'd like to draw your attention to a new podcast on the history of science, technology and medicine. The new cast is entitled The Missing Link and produced and presented by Elizabeth Green Musselman, an Associate Professor of History at Southwestern University in Austin, Texas. The first two episodes are now available. Episode 1, entitled Stranger Than Fiction, considers some of the ways that science fiction has drawn inspiration from planetary science. Episode 2, entitled Opposites Attract, examines the seemingly obvious idea that women and men are opposites. You can listen to the Missing Link podcast at missinglinkpodcast.com. That is all for this edition of Exploring Environmental History. And don't forget that you can find the latest environmental history news on the website at www.eh-resources.org. I hope that you will be joining me next time when I will be exploring global warming and the environmental history of Arctic Canada. This is Jan Oosthoek from Newcastle upon Tyne.